Gordon, you've ruined everything.
And that's the start of the show now. I did ruin everything. So we're actually live now.
Oh, hi.
So I'm going to start this unceremoniously because that's just what we do. I'm Gordon McAlpin. I do Multiplex.
I'm Joe Dunn. I do Jello's Crappy Movies.
I'm Tom Brazelton. And we run a tight ship.
And this is Punk. He draws Multiplex.
I love how enamored he is right now and terrified. Poor animal.
He's not. He wasn't really happy, but.
Oh, Punk.
He's going to go sulk somewhere. I gave him medicine earlier anyway. So.
Medicine.
So, yeah, this is what we do. This is what we do on the Triple Feature. We talk about cats.
Yeah.
So we had a whole different show kind of planned for tonight. We were going to talk about Robot and Frank, starring Frank Langella, and Avengers AI and Almost Human. We had a better idea, or events, circumstances conspired to give us a more topical subject, a sober subject. Poor choice of word.
Yeah, no.
But anyway, Philip Seymour Hoffman has passed away, as anybody who is a film lover has probably already heard.
Wait a minute. Before we bury the lead here, tell them that we'll also be talking about something else tonight.
We're also going to talk about the Lego Movie, because after talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman, we need to cheer up. So, listen to us talk about depressing shit for half an hour. Give or take, and then come back, or just, you know, stick with us, and we'll talk about the Lego Movie by Chris Miller and Phil Lord, creators of Clone High. Or,
God, I love that show.
Yeah, that was a great show.
We'll get into that.
Yep. So, we didn't have any big format plan for the night. Did either of you want to simply start off talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman? What was the first movie that you guys remember seeing him in and being, you know, well, taking notice of him as an actor as opposed to just thinking it was, you know, a guy in a movie?
I can answer that. I remember seeing him in Twister. He left an impression, and that's a backhanded compliment. My favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman performance was in Twister, but no, like I remember seeing him in Twister originally and going like, oh wow, they got kind of like the generic, you know, loud science nerd character in there, right? And then a few years later, he was in Boogie Nights, where I can't remember the character's name, but he was very like shy and reserved the whole time. And I think that's when like it started to kind of click with me who Philip Seymour Hoffman was. So when I went back and watched Twister again like years later, I was like, oh yeah, he's in that movie. Like, not that guy. He is not that guy at all. So everybody, over the week, people were talking about like some of their favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman performances. I really think like Twister should be up there. It's a crap movie, but he does such a good job in it. I don't, you know, playing that kind of archetype, that annoying archetype. I don't know. That's a clumsy way to start, but that's definitely where I remember him from first.
You know, my first memory of Paul Giamatti is in Private Parts, and granted, Private Parts is actually a very good movie, but the role of Pig Vomit is not really, what really comes to mind for most people. So,
Pig Vomit is Paul Giamatti.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said it was Philip Seymour Hoffman.
No, I know.
He's making a connection, Joe.
Go on.
Whatever. Not exactly a segue. But anyway, I was just saying there was a parallel there that Paul Giamatti, fantastic actor, found, and I first discovered him or started paying attention to his work through something that was maybe a little bit atypical for him. For me, I think, you know, I first saw Philip Seymour Hoffman with Boogie Nights, like a lot of people. You know, I hadn't seen, I had never seen Twister. If I had, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have noticed him. But yeah, no, Boogie Nights was it for me. And then, I suppose, I don't know. I mean, I don't even remember him in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, me neither.
I think the next one, the next film with him in it that I really noticed him in was The Talented Mr. Ripley. I came to Magnolia a little bit late. I don't know why, but after Boogie Nights, for some reason Paul Thomas Anderson was still not quite on my radar yet, in terms of, you know, I'm wanting to make a concerted effort to see every single thing that he comes out with, no matter how uninteresting it might possibly look. You know, Magnolia was a tough sell, I think, to a lot of people. Certainly it was to me at the time, but you know, now if Paul Thomas Anderson's attached to something, I'll watch it no matter what. Joe,
I would say that it's weird that your first association with Paul Giamatti is a film that's not very him, because my first thing with Paul Giamatti is Big Mama's House. That's the first time I noticed him, and that's totally not Paul Giamatti.
Which but anyway, one?
Big Mama's House?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like your phone
Big
just
Mama's
agreed
boyfriend.
With you. Just like Big Mama's House.
You know, yeah, no, never seen those movies.
Oh, you're missing out, believe me. Anyway. That's a real Seymour Hoffman.
He didn't actually do the second one, did he?
No, he's not the second one, no.
Okay, yeah. He was like, okay, that was a paycheck.
No, yeah.
I have cred now.
For me and Philip Seymour Hoffman, though, it's got to be, the first thing I really remember him from was Almost Famous. And I think it's because I was too young Magnolia and The Big Lebowski when they first came out. And even for something like Boogie Nights, like, he's not the first thing you notice. I mean, there's a lot of nudity.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get that stuff out of your head. And he's great in that movie, but he's great upon revisits. Whereas in something like Almost Famous, I mean, I think we were all age appropriate for that movie. Like, it's a movie about hope and about, you know, finding creativity. And he's plays Lester Banks, who's like this character that inspires you and inspires the main character. So he's kind of this important figure, you know, to what the movie represents, and he really stood out there. And then beyond that, I mean, if you go up and down, it's crazy. He's in so many great movies.
Yeah.
I mean, beyond that, yeah.
Like State in Maine, I didn't love, but I think it was that year. Well, no, I guess it wasn't that year, but in that kind of 1999 through early 2000s, like when he was in just a ton of stuff. I never saw Flawless, but, you know, he was in Flawless, Magnolia, Talented Mr. Ripley, State in Maine, Almost Famous, Love, Liza, Punch Drunk Love was another, like, huge one for me.
He's terrifying in that movie.
Yeah.
I've not watched Punch Drunk Love in a few years, but a lot of, like, the anxiety that Adam Sandler's character feels in that movie comes from Hoffman, and it's totally justified. Stressed me out in that movie, so I totally got it. Very, very good performance, too, for not a lot of screen time.
You know, I just saw Punch Drunk Love for the first time, like, a month ago.
Really?
And he's so scary in that movie. Like, when they do the face-off at the end,
yeah,
he's just breathing, and it's like, oh, man, his sleep apnea is even worse when he's awake.
Was the shut-up part, was that at the end, or was that earlier in the film? I don't remember anymore.
It's right at the end. It's in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah. No, like that, I was so taken aback by that choice. I don't know if it was in the script, or if it was Philip, you know, Seymour Hoffman himself that came up with that reading of, you know, just saying shut up. But, but it was such a brilliant choice because it took you off guard, and you know you think about it for a second, you're like, well, that's what it's supposed to do. And so, I mean, you know, whether it was him or the script or some combination, he sold that. And what could have been really weird and just kind of awkward.
Speaking of selling it, in that movie he plays a mattress salesman as his legit business. And if you YouTube it, I don't know, someone sent this to me after I watched the movie, I'd never seen it before, but he does like this fake mattress, King of Mattresses commercial, where he's on the top of a building and he walks across and I think he's playing a guitar and he's like, come down to my warehouse, blah, 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 blah. And he's walking up and you see there's this pile of mattresses stacked on top of a car and he's on top of a building. He jumps off the building, lands on the mattresses, and falls off the mattresses onto the ground. And it is just like, I mean, it's like they did it on purpose, but he really falls and it's really hilarious. And it's like 10 minutes long, whatever, or 5 minutes, whatever.
You know, it's funny because as, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson is not as not known for comedy, but he's fucking funny when he wants to be. I would really be curious to see if he could do. I'm getting sidetracked. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, I want to see him do something that is much more of a, you know, kind of a black comedy sort of thing. And I guess maybe Punch Drunk Love had some elements of that. But you know, I kind of feel like it was more of a romantic, weird movie.
Yeah.
But
well,
I wish he could do that, like the way that Spielberg will do two movies a year, or like he went through that period where he was doing two movies a year. I wish that Paul Thomas Anderson could do his masterpiece and then 2 years later do just like a quick 90-minute comedy like he did with Punch Drunk Love, and then go back 2 years later to do the, you know, 3-hour masterpiece, whatever. I wish he could find that rhythm. Be great.
You know, it's really kind of weird because it's difficult to talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman and not talk about Paul Thomas Anderson because they seemed very kind of aligned. I mean, certainly with he was basically his, you know, touch point in a lot of different movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking through his IMDb profile, and I own Boogie Nights, and that's it. And I was thinking about this, like, Paul Thomas Anderson movies are movies that I love dearly, but only want to watch once.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm kicking myself now because I have not yet seen The Master. It came and went in Des Moines, like, mm-hmm. faster than you could blink. So we never got a chance to see it. And so now I'm thinking, like, I might just go and buy that on Blu-ray just to have it. Because there's quality in the work always.
I would say, I mean, it's definitely a fantastic film. I did miss that one in theaters. But as soon as it was available to watch streaming, I sat up in bed, and this is just dumb. I knew it had been shot partly or mostly in 65mm, but I was sitting in bed, and I started watching on my iPad, and like 5 seconds in or so, I'm like, what am I doing? I need to get up and watch this on a TV at least, because it is so beautifully shot. It is a very creepy character study of the Master, of course, but also Joaquin Phoenix as basically his dog. Seriously, and it is disturbing as shit. And they both knock it out of the park. Have I used that phrase like a million times already in this show?
Third sentence.
I'm sorry. Well, I'm just gonna keep knocking it out of the park again. But no, I mean, it's a fantastic movie. It is one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's it's his showcase role for him, and he does an amazing job in it. He knocks it out of the park.
Is it weird that, I mean, like, this is kind of a morbid question, but you know, like, they, whenever an actor dies, everybody goes, like, here's a movie that they were working on, this is going to be their last performance. Like, Paul Walker's last movie is coming out, I think, in a couple of months. I don't know.
He had a few in the can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they're talking about that they won't have to do significant changes for Mockingjay Part 2, the Hunger Games he's in.
There was, from what I understand, there were some really tiny bits in some of the other ones, but there was one full scene. He had about a week of work left for that one full scene. And they're talking about digitally replacing him somehow. I don't know what they're going to do for audio. Maybe they had a read-through or something that they could use. But
well, if you go back to Mission Impossible 3, he does say that phrase that Tom Cruise then uses so he can replicate his voice in any sound. So he says the one phrase that makes all sounds, So yeah. if any movie fans here, they understand how that works.
Wow.
Yeah,
to jump down from the highbrow film, stuff for a few seconds. You did just bring up Mission Impossible 3. How creepy of a villain is he in that movie? I mean, he makes that movie work.
He's wonderful in that movie, and like it's a step down only because he does it right after Capote, the movie he won the Oscar for.
Yeah,
but he's great in Mission Impossible 3. He's fantastic.
But you know, I mean, that's not like jumping from Bowfinger to Norbit, though. Or what was the
Dream Girls to Norbit?
Dream Girls. Sorry. I don't remember my any movies. But yeah, no, I mean, it's not quite the same. I mean, at least Mission Impossible 3 was a good action movie, and he is such a good villain in it. Those movies they didn't have a very good villain in the first two. I mean, I didn't think so anyway. It was just sort of
annoying. They were the villain.
Hmm?
Well, what's his name was Dougray Scott.
Yeah.
Where's what happened to him? Poor Dougray.
Well, he was supposed to be Wolverine, and then he didn't get to be a star. Anyway.
But he does Mission Impossible 3. He goes big budget, and I think that was his biggest movie. If you don't count, I mean, Catching Fire later, is his biggest blockbuster hit.
Yeah,
he's great in Mission Impossible 3. But after that, he does in 2008. He did Synecdoche, New York, which is probably my favorite film of his, favorite performance. I think he's so good in that movie, and it's such a weird and wonderful movie. And if you haven't seen it, you gotta see it. He did it the same year he did Doubt, which he's awesome in. I need to watch that again. I need to see Doubt again.
Doubt is good. Schenectady, New York. Was that the last one that Charlie Kaufman did? Now, Internet Movie Database.
One and only, right?
Is a rabbit hole. But that was the last one he wrote. Last one he directed. Yeah,
I think it's the only.
That was a while ago. It's like, where is his movie? Yeah, crap.
Well, you saw the adaptation. You know exactly where he is.
Yeah, tortured
inner child.
I don't know. I mean, kind of, not to make it a downer thing, but going back to finding out that he had died, I think I found out that he died last Sunday, and I was like, no way. Yeah, well, you know, like, I just happened to be on Twitter as it came through, and I was like, no way, celebrity death hoax, it happens all the time. Quick jump over to Google, you know, seeing if there's any news items on it, nothing. Except for one article that said, death hoax. About him, so like he had been the subject of a death hoax before. So I was like, oh, okay.
Wasn't that fucking Media Matters or whatever it was? I can't remember the name of it. There's some website that has just like an automatically generated page on death hoaxes for just like just about every celebrity you can name. It's because they're automatically generated, and so like they basically capitalize, they exist to capitalize on that moment of confusion after, you know, it's been revealed, whatever, after the news breaks and before people have any really like steady, you know, source for it. So like people like go to these pages. It happened with
everybody.
Everybody. but I can't remember the last time I had actually come across that site. Oh, it was Paul Walker, actually. It's disgusting that they actually have a site to capitalize off of celebrity deaths and death hoaxes.
Disgusting, but not surprising.
No, not really.
Yeah, I don't know. When I read it first, it didn't land on me at all. I just kind of thought like, oh. Him, of all people, didn't seem to match up. And I honestly didn't know anything about his history of drug abuse. That was a surprise to me as well. So I don't want to get into the whys or the, you know, what happened or anything like that. It was just so very left field to me that the whole thing, like when you started seeing people going, oh no, and they're kind of eulogizing the man, it still doesn't quite feel real to me because Hoffman is always going to be that actor in my head that could have worked forever. He could have worked into his 80s. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He's totally reliable, totally believable in any role he steps into. Unconventional for a Hollywood star or even a character actor. I don't even think of him as a character actor. I just think of him as a good actor. So, you know, I'm trying to think of other, you know, what, elderly actors to compare him to. Who's working in their 80s right now? Not a whole lot of people, but I see he could have been around for a long time and kept working. So that's the tragedy of it to me. You know, would Paul Walker have worked into his 80s? Probably not. Not to, you know, weigh one life against another. I'm just saying, you know, artistically.
Well, it just goes to show, like, how easily he can slip between being sort of a lead to a master villain to, like, you know, just a great character actor. You look at a movie like Moneyball or even Charlie Wilson's War, where he comes in and he does these little side characters, but he steals the show, and he's really great. I had no idea about the drug thing either, and I think that is a testament to how good he is, like, on screen and how quiet he is in his personal life, but I never thought about him in his personal life. You know, I was always loved the performance, loved him as an actor, but, like, wasn't even thinking about what was going on with, you know, drug use or anything, really.
Yeah. He was never one for the tabloids. And, you know, I guess that's...
Except the bikini pics, am I right? Whoa. Yeah.
The one advantage to not being a hot guy in Hollywood is you don't get...
They leave you alone.
Yeah. Because you could be a not hot woman and just get eaten alive because you're not hot enough, and so therefore you're not deserving of their adulation. And if you're a hot woman, then you're either being eaten alive or worshipped or both at the same time. But yeah, like not hot dudes, they pretty much don't give a shit about you.
Well, I don't know that I have anything particularly insightful to add about it. About Hoffman, you know, it just, and I don't, if you guys have other thoughts on it, please feel free. It's just, to me, it's a damn shame. It's a shame when anybody dies. It's really a shame when it, you know, how they die kind of undoes your understanding of them. Not that we were ever close to the guy. We don't know shit about Philip Seymour Hoffman other than what he put on screen. I thank him for that. But, you know, you add up the sum of his work, and then you go like, well, this, you have this picture in your mind. Well, this is who this person kind of is. And then over here is heroin abuse. It just is so jarring. I think that's why people are still kind of reeling and processing it.
So favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman role? Let's create a little movie watch list for those of the people in our audience who are not as familiar, maybe. With his work, Joe.
Yeah, you got to watch Synecdoche, New York. I think it's just a unique masterpiece, and he's at, you know, at the center of it, and he's brilliant throughout. I wish there was something, you know, something a little bit more accessible, because it really is a mind fuck. Like it's such a like, there were people that will hate it and they will hate me for telling them to watch it. But Almost Famous, I think, is an easy one that everyone will love, and he's great in it.
I'm gonna second Almost Famous, but also add in Punch Drunk Love, simply because of the shut up scene. It's ingrained in me with him. I can't separate him.
I'm having trouble picking one, honestly. I agree with Joe that Schenectady is such a great film. It's a hard film to like. Doubt, also, his performance is really good, but also a hard character to like. I don't want to recommend something where he's like, he's a dick in that movie. honestly, The Savages is very good. I think that maybe speaks... That's probably as close as we get to knowing Philip Seymour Hoffman is through that movie. Capote. I remember seeing that in the theater and was blown away.
Every movie he's been in.
Yeah, I know. I just can't. I can't land on one. I can't.
Well, you were saying you have a love for Along Came Polly. You like that movie? What's your favorite movie?
I'm more of a Big Mama's House guy myself, but he wasn't in that one. No, you know what? I think the more I'm looking at the list, I'm kind of narrowing it down. He's very good as Lester Bangs in Almost Famous. If you are going to watch Almost Famous, I definitely recommend the extended version, the director's cut. Don't fuck around with the studio cut. But I'm for a pure Hoffman experience. Since Joe already picks Schenectady, I would drive people to Capote. I think he clearly had a love for Truman Capote as a writer and as a celebrity, for lack of a better word, and does a very good job showing how Capote evolved during the trial. The last act of that movie is devastating, too.
I haven't seen Capote since 2005. I gotta watch it again.
It is good. It's a slow burn of a movie, but he leads you through the Capote's kind of transformation so effortlessly that it reminds you that Capote himself was actually, I mean, he's a very capable writer. He wasn't just a pithy,
pretty face
caricature. Also, Big Mama's House.
I just want to say before we start talking about it, he died on Super Bowl Sunday. On Groundhog's Day, and just as I was sitting down for I, Frankenstein, and I think I was so upset that it ruined the movie for me.
Isn't that the worst?
That's the worst.
Stuff like that happens.
I, Frankenstein could have been great, but I found out I got bad news right before.
These things aren't related at all, but it's like, well, I can't recommend I, Frankenstein now because I'm too concerned. I'm over here. Can't give it my full attention. Oh, hell. Well, all cheers right. To Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. We'll miss you, buddy. I'm talking to Philip Seymour Hoffman there.
And to Tom, mute.
So, the latest film from Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and Clone High creators Chris Miller and Phil Lord has just come out. They're also the directors of 21 Jump Street and the forthcoming sequel, 22 Jump Street. The Lego Movie. It is an hour and a half commercial for the Lego toys and all that that implies, and a whole lot of other things that it doesn't imply. Tom, let's start with you.
It's funny that Joe was talking about how Philip Seymour Hoffman's death kind of affected his enjoyment of I, Frankenstein, because this is... I had like a very lousy week last week. Job stuff, not important, and also had a situation where I was just wanting to get to the end of the week so I could see the Lego Movie. Just give me to Friday. We're going to take the kids, we're going to hug them tight, we're going to have a fucking awesome time. Then my son had a very terrible day at school, and we're like, you can't go to the movie. We had to do the parent thing where, you know, it would be totally crossed signals if we said, like, this behavior is totally unacceptable. You did not do the thing that you were supposed to do at school. But let's all go to the Lego Movie. Like, no. So he stayed at home.
What you should have done is go to the Lego Movie, but make him watch The Monuments Men instead.
Oh! You will appreciate art by the time this is over, boy. No, so we took our daughter and... I mean, we all really, really loved it. I just had that thing on the periphery where it's like, my son would love this, but I'm doing the fatherly thing, and I can't let him, it was crap. Personal circumstances aside, it's friggin' fantastic, this movie, and it is the thing that should not be. That's kind of my attitude about the Lego Movie. I remember when they started advertising it, and I'm like, this is a horrible idea. I love Legos, but the Lego Movie... What will it be? What could it possibly be about? It doesn't even register. And then you were like, oh, they're releasing it in February. It's got to be a real turd burglar of a movie. Like, no reason for this thing to exist at all. The commercials start coming out, the trailers, the commercials, and you're just kind of like, oh, this looks funny. Oh, it's got Batman. Okay. It just chiseled me down to the point where you're like, obviously, this is the best thing that ever happened. And you go in, and it's better than that. You go and sit down, and you watch it, and it is better than what you're thinking. Everybody who's wetting their pants on Facebook about it right now, they're wrong. You want to know why they're wrong? It's better than what your friends are telling you. They will say it is the best movie they've seen in their lives, their entire miserable lives. They're right, but it's better than that. That's how good this movie is. It's pure. I'll put this another way. having walked out of that movie, I felt like someone had hacked the pleasure center of my brain. Like, it was completely unnatural that I walked out of that thing enjoying it as much as I did. And I also, I was a little guarded about it because I'm like, has my sense of taste, like, de-evolved a little bit? You know, I've got kids. A lot of the movies that we go see in theaters anymore is our kids' movies. So I'm like, well, this is much better than The Lorax. Yeah, it's better than The Lorax. The Lorax is shit.
For the trees, come on.
You know, oh, no, The Lorax is shit. So boring. It's a mustache for...
It's the Borax.
The Borax. It was the Borax. And I got my shirt amazingly cleaned, oddly, after we left. No, the Lego movie is fantastic, and it's going to be one of those movies, too, that you'll go back and watch again, and you'll catch new stuff in every time. I know this in my heart. So I know I've given it quite effusive praise. I'll dial back a little bit. I'll let you guys go, but I'm telling you, anything that you say critical about it, you're wrong.
I think, Tom, I think you just said it was the greatest movie ever made.
Yes. And I meant it.
All right. Okay. Points to where you...
It is certainly the funniest movie I've seen in multiple years. Since 21 Jump Street, easily. I mean, it is their best film. It's better than Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which I absolutely adore. It is like all of the high points of Clone High strung together, but, you know, not except for one or two actual, well, one at least one recycled gag from Clone High, the dolphin noise with the sharks.
And I just oh right, yes.
I thought I just missaw them. I thought they were dolphins, and I was just like, oh, those dolphins look like sharks. I didn't. You know.
Yeah, but no, except for a couple of those drugs, it's completely new, and that's the crazy thing about these guys is that they can. I mean, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs is probably another movie that you could say didn't have any right to exist. Yeah. 21 Jump Street is a movie that didn't have any right to exist, and both of those are way better than you would expect. The Lego movie was the same. But, I mean, the Lego movie I was on board with already, just because I knew that they were involved, and after seeing 21 Jump Street and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and Clone High, I'm up for anything they do. They could, I don't know, they could do Big Mama's House 4, and I would be on board with it, not having seen the Big Mama's House trilogy.
That's actually accurate praise. I really think that's accurate praise because everything that they've touched, yeah, is much better than the original source material. I'll add too,
are you going to shit on six seasons of 21 Jump Street like that?
I'll explain why. Two words: Richard Grieco.
Hey, no one's talking about Booker. It's all Johnny Depp. Come on.
Name me one other character from that show.
Their character names or their actors?
Yes.
Peter DeLuise, Holly Robinson P.
Okay.
Black
okay.
Captain. His name is Black Captain, right?
Black Captain. You crazy kids! No, the other thing that I was also thinking about, and this doesn't apply to 21 Jump Street, really, but between the Lego movie and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, these are two, like, the most colorful, richly satisfying movies in a visual sense that I think I can call up at the top of my brain. Like, not even Pixar movies don't look this bright to me. I don't know if that's a fair comparison or not, but it's just like I remember when I watched Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs for the first time, and I was like, this is very, very well thought out, just in terms of the feel of the movie. And for an animated film, that's hard to do. So I don't know if that's them or if they just got excellent guys at Sony and Warner Brothers who understand what they want. But, yeah, that was another thing that I liked about the best movie that was ever made.
So what you guys were saying by Animal Logic. And Animal Logic, if I remember correctly, is best known for doing some just, like, internet viral videos. I'm going to have to look that up. I don't know. They're not a big studio. This is their first thing, and I mean, they knocked it out of the park. No, they did a fantastic job with it. there are definitely points where I cannot tell what's real and what isn't, because it is a blend of some stop motion elements, I think largely backgrounds really, and see actual, like, you know, CGI, and I don't really know, like, you know, like, looking at it, everything looks so real. The attention to detail that they put into the CG models is amazing. The little Lego figurines have, you know, a nice little bumpy plastic texture. They have a little wear and tear in some of them where it's appropriate. The astronaut guy has a little split on his helmet.
As they all do now.
If you can find one mint, yeah, hang on to that shit.
Yeah, there was a New York Times article where they talked about how they put together the look of the film, and they actually calculated how much dust and dandruff, they called this out, how much dust and dandruff needed to be floating in the air to feel real, but not, you know, gross.
Well, the thing I noticed, too, with texturizing on the characters, like, they had thumbprints on them. Did you notice that?
I did notice one or two. Like, I think there was, like, a little grease thumbprint, yeah.
Which is very clever, and, I'll preface, we made a pact not to talk about the third act at all.
Right.
You're talking about it now.
I know.
It's saying one more thumbprint and then saying not talking about it, you're talking about it. I'll bring
some
points back to what you were saying earlier.
It enhances that stop motion illusion is what I was going to say with the thumbprint, where you're like, oh, okay, well, it makes sense that, you know, these people are being adjusted, and, you know, just a small thing that I like.
Well, you know, they're Legos. They're Legos.
Tiny.
Move them around. So, but yeah, no, I mean, by way of explanation for people who haven't seen the Lego movie yet, and dear God, just go watch it. But if you haven't seen it, the reason we don't want to talk about the third act is because the whole film has just a lot of really wonderful surprises. Some really tiny, some actually, you know, rather big, you know, big budget animated film spoilers can go. And so we want to preserve that. I having read three or four or more reviews of the film before I'd even set foot in the theater, I was still surprised by so much. Like, one point I was practically squeeing at something that I won't mention. But it is now. Anyway, it's a really funny film, and it functions really well as a family kind of adventure story too. So that's why we're not going to get too much into spoiler territory. Joe, I think Tom's been monopolizing the conversation because he's like, oh, I have like seven children and therefore my opinion is more valid than yours.
With the father's perspective.
Oh, you son of a bitch, Tom, I'm talking now. All right, well, there are a couple things that you guys said that really connected with me. Like, you saw Batman in the promo and you're like, oh, cool, Batman's going to be in this. And you would also see like Superman and Wonder Woman in the promos and like Michelangelo and Michelangelo, you know, there were things like that that were really cool. I had no idea to the extent that Batman was actually in this thing. Like, he is in this thing. Like, if this is the Wizard of Oz, he's the Cowardly Lion. He's all over this thing. Like, it's amazing that they can get away with that sort of thing. Not just using characters from all different properties and universes, but really having a lot of fun with it and doing it great. And Tom said earlier, when you go back and you watch this again, you'll see things that you didn't see the first time. And for me, that's what really, really got me with the movie. Like, in the opening scene, there's one character, he's walking towards another character, and he steps over the thing, and it's just in the background, but he breaks the guy's cane. And I was like, oh, it's that kind of party. Like, that's what's going to happen. There's going to be things going on everywhere that I'm going to love. Like, you know, and from there on out, I had a keen eye for anything I could see, and I know that if I watch this movie again, I'm going to see another dozen things that I didn't see the first time, or the second time, or the third time. And it's just like that. Like, the main character, he wakes up in a city, and there's a thousand things to see, and they're all clever, and they're all smart, and they're all fun.
In Emmett's apartment, there's actually a poster for popular band.
Yeah. It's the Beatles, but yeah. Yeah, it's great. There's a ton of stuff like that. Now, to you guys saying it's the best movie ever, I will say everything that everyone has heard about the movie is accurate. It's really great. It's really fun. Is it the best movie ever?
No, I was not.
All right, let me dial it back a bit.
Let me keep talking for a second.
This is the best movie I've seen this week.
It's a great movie. There were times, though, where I was like, do these characters, are they clearly defined enough? Do they need to be defined enough? I wasn't worried about it, though. And to be honest, there's two characters that are really well-defined, and they're well-defined in, like, really minuscule ways, just kind of like this wild child. This is one character's name, and there's just a joke about how she's had a thousand different names, and that says so much about her as a character, and it's important, but it's a little thing. But yeah, I worried about plot progression and things like that, and I worried about if I should be worried about plot progression. But I'll say this. There's a key scene in the movie that's a key scene in the promotion. It's the scene where Emmett addresses everybody in this sort of round table coliseum thing. And that's the kind of scene you expect to be the third scene in the movie, but it's not. And I thought that was great because there was a lot of build up before that, and it's a lot of fun. It's, you know, as someone who watches trailers and kind of hangs too much on trailers, like the anticipation of seeing certain things from trailers, this movie, which had a great trailer, still is a great movie.
Yes.
definitely.
I'm trying to think what to build on that without going too far into it, but the movie also does a very good job of talking about, it has a very interesting theme, or kind of like a side conflict, and that Emmett as the lead character is blank, basically. Like, he's not special in any way, follows the instructions meticulously, and then is thrown into a group of quote-unquote master builders, who are all these, you know, licensed property characters who can build whatever they want, see, you know, all sorts of possibility in the world. So you have this very interesting kind of dichotomy between the guy who kind of is, you know, fun-loving and very positive, but kind of demands order, and these people who are almost pure chaos by comparison. They have to work together. So how that resolves is very satisfying.
No, it's not. No. What's the message of the movie? Is it to be the chaos creative person, or is it to follow the instructions, or is it somewhere in the middle?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. There's a scene in it where, like, everybody wants to build whatever they want, and they say, this isn't going to work if you guys don't... You guys have to work together, because I think that's where I saw it kind of going.
See, it's not an absolutist movie, and it's kind of funny that we're analyzing it this deeply.
But that's the point of the movie. There's a conflict of what they're trying to say in the movie, and I don't know. There's not a clear resolution, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's the way it is.
Well, here's what I was thinking. Like, what does the Lego company want us to think walking away from this movie, right? Because, I mean, Gordon said at the top of this part of the show that it's basically a big commercial for Lego, and it is, but who doesn't love Lego? That's like saying, like, Oreo the movie. Who doesn't love an Oreo? They're delicious.
I love Lego, but I haven't thought about playing with them in 20 years. But after watching this movie, I was like, geez, I better go out and get me some Batman Lego.
I gotta get some sets.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, Lego as a company sells these sets and says, follow, you know, do this, A plus B plus, you know, and then you get the finished thing, but then what? Versus...
No, that's actually true. It's been kind of a criticism of Lego that they release so many sets now, and, you know, there's this idea that, you know, like when we were kids, if you wanted to make a computer, you stuck a red brick on top of a yellow brick, yeah. And that was a computer. Now they have the computer brick and the hyperdrive brick. And, you know, so, and I think it's interesting, though, that, you know, that is, at the same time, they do need to have some of these things, but they do sometimes maybe overdo it a little bit. Like the biggest, the most variation they really get is in the figures, though, and I think that comes through the movie too. But it's so there is kind of this balance between only making things according to the instructions and the whole point of the Lego, which is to do what you want, and you know. The bad guy wants it one way, absolutely, and there's this ideal that, you know, it's you think that it's supposed to be the other way, but I think, yeah, it's supposed to be somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah.
Because...
Well, what Lego ended up doing was something very clever, because they basically made it so that Lego's for everybody. It can be for the guy who wants it to be, you know, that has to follow the instructions, and it can be for the crazy chaotic people who want to go all over the place, too. So... It's just one of those things that, like, how do you articulate the intrinsic value of a toy? It's kind of personal, and Lego almost even more so, because so much of your imagination can be dumped into these blocks. You know, you can either just follow the path they give, or you can just go whole hog. My son's going to be 7, and he's in a big Lego phase right now. I was very against buying sets for him.
Because he was so much trouble at school.
What?
Because he was in trouble at school.
He wanted it. No. He kept wanting to just make his own thing, and the teacher said no. And no. But, like, I was very much against it because I said I want him to, you know, understand, you know, think. I don't know. The three of us are creative people, so I think that's why we're kind of diving into this a little bit more than most people would. But I wanted to give him just the blocks and see what he could make with just the blocks. The stuff that he produces is amazing to me. Like, he's like, he made, like, a stage for his characters to dance on. He made a house with, like, 3 rooms in it. No instructions. Amazing. But then the other flip of that coin is that, like, I got an Iron Man Lego set for my birthday. 35.
For yourself.
Yeah. For myself. He wanted to help me with that so badly that he could taste it. Okay, so we work on it together, and he does a really good job with the instructions. There's another value in that, because it, you know, if you mess it up, then he has to learn to go back and fix that mistake from like 3, you know, pages ago. You know what I mean? So there's like, it helps him in a different way. So I don't know. I really appreciated that they gave that kind of thought to Legos in the movie. It wasn't just like, you know, color and noise and witty jokes and pop culture references and just shoved in your face. There was a subtext there that made it meaningful, and I think that's what people are really reacting to.
I mean, that's what really makes it so much a Lego movie as opposed to just some movie based on some arbitrary licensed property with the Lego name stuck on it. Like, I don't know how much you guys have seen with any of the other Lego stuff, like the Lego cartoon straight-to-video stuff. Or the video games, I guess. They're most it's just Batman or Star Wars or whatever with Legos.
Yeah.
This is a completely different thing. You know, aside from just the style of animation being, you know, more realistic in the sense that they look like actual toys rather than these kind of bendy computer models. You know, it's about the toy. In that, even that philosophical sense of what Lego means.
And that's what's so diabolical about their marketing campaign to make us buy toys.
Yeah.
This 90-minute product placement masterpiece.
It's absolutely working. We're having my son's birthday party next week, and it's Lego movie. He hasn't even seen the movie. So in the back of my head, I'm like, I hope he has a good week this week so I can take him before his birthday party, because it's going to be really uncomfortable if he's going to get out and see it.
All right. So I think that about wraps it up for the night. Any final thoughts about the Lego movie? How many thumbs up? 3 thumbs up?
Out of what? Out of both our thumbs?
The one thing that I'll add about the Lego movie is pay close attention to all the different characters. There's a lot of cameos in that film that some of them you'll catch, some of them are a little bit more subtle, but if you go and look at the IMDb page, or, you know what, go see the movie, try it, see if you can recognize any of them.
Don't look at the IMDb page.
No, yeah, don't. No.
It will spoil some great surprises.
True. Yeah, honestly. I guess you're right. But
I want to mention one character, and it's Bad Cop, Good Cop by Liam Neeson.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So good, brilliant. I thought, like, he really... It's a wonderful, like, double performance and really funny and in the movie enough to be worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, and also, how often does Liam Neeson do comedy? Rare, if ever.
I guess you didn't see Big Mama's House 4.
Oh!
No, that was true. I don't know. Let me see his last comedy.
Well, like, I know he had that thing on Extras where he wanted to tell jokes about people with AIDS.
Oh, Star Wars Episode 1.
No! Joe wins. Joe wins.
All right.
That's all I got. I'm leaving it there.
I guess that's it for the night. Thank you very much for joining me, Joe and Tom, and my cats wandered off, so sorry. And thank you very much for watching. That's it, I guess. Say bye, Joe.
Bye. Oh, we will be watching we'll do the review eventually of Robot and Frank and Almost Human and Avengers AI. I will say that one is wonderful, one is okay, and one is terrible.
I think I know which ones you're talking about.
Oh, good leader.
All right, thanks very much. Bye.